Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Here we are in the trial number two of Karen Reed. What we're going to do here is break down what was said by the prosecution, what was said by the defense in opening statements, and compare and contrast what's going on here. What two completely different narratives are going to be heard by a jury, by you, by me, by everybody? How can they be so damn different of the same night? That's up for everyone to decide. We're going to kind of cut it down the middle. We're going to start with the prosecution because that's the first one that went today. Then we're going to go to defense, and then we're going to go and talk about all of it as a whole. We're not trying to make this a one-sided video or audio at all. We're just trying to go down the middle. Please press subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast, or if you're on YouTube, press subscribe there. And if you're on YouTube, be sure to comment. Let us know what you think about all of this. The key is have some context with your comments. Don't just say free Karen Reed. Don't just say she's guilty. Give us some thoughts. Give us some feedback. Give us some depth, because this is not as black and white as many are making it out to be. So do that, please. And I'm going to begin with the story here. It was 6:04 a.m. on January 29th of 2022 when the alarm went off at the Canton Fire Department. Snow was falling hard. A winter storm was still plummeting the town. But when the call came in, cardiac arrest, 34 Fairview Road, firefighter and paramedic Timothy Nuttall did not hesitate. He knew the drill. This wasn't just a slip on ice or a fender bender. Cardiac arrest means the clock is ticking. Someone's heart has stopped. And in that moment, every second counts. He grabbed his gear, jumped in the back of his ambulance as it slid through the slush towards a residential street blanketed in darkness and snow. As they approached the house, the blizzard blurred the landscape. But one thing cut through the chaos. A woman's scream. Nuttall followed the sound and came upon a man lying motionless in the snow, surrounded by three distraught women. He checked for signs of life. Nothing. No pulse. No movement. Just a body on frozen ground. That man was John O'Keefe, Boston police officer, father figure who had two orphaned children in his care, and according to the Commonwealth, a victim of homicide. Now, here's where the prosecution story starts taking shape. As paramedics worked to retrieve O'Keefe, firefighter Nuttall says Karen Reed, John's girlfriend, walked up to him and allegedly said something that stuck with him. I hit him. I hit him. I hit him. She was crying, frantic, but the words were clear enough for Nuttall to remember. And he wasn't the only one. At least two other first responders claimed they heard her say the same thing, one of them quoting her as saying, "Oh my God, I hit him." These are people with no dog in the fight, remember. These are first responders. No one was sitting at their home going, "Hey, I wonder if Karen's going to hit somebody tonight, or if her the friends of John O'Keefe are going to beat him up and throw him in the yard. And we have to say that she's claiming that I hit him." That makes no sense. From that moment on, Karen Reed wasn't just the grieving girlfriend. She became the focus of a criminal investigation. Where did that go? Where does that take us in this story? Well, it isn't just a case about what was said in the heat of panic. The prosecution says that this is a case built on science. Hard data, objective truth, and in their version of events, holds up, if it holds up, then John O'Keefe didn't just die on a snowy lawn. He died because Karen Reed allegedly got angry, drove off, changed her mind, and then reversed her SUV straight into him. That is the narrative of the prosecution. According to the state, it all started earlier that night at a bar called McGuire's, where Reed and O'Keefe were out drinking with friends. They then moved to another spot, the Waterfall. Surveillance video allegedly shows Reed consuming at least 7 vodka drinks over the course of the night, not sipping cocktails over the course of an evening. We're talking multiple drinks under 2 hours. It's a lot. It's a lot in 2 hours. 7 drinks in 2 hours? Of course, Karen says, oh, I didn't drink all of them, but this or that, you know. Also says she doesn't remember dropping him off, too. So it's called blackout. She likes to claim that she doesn't do that, but you know what? Anybody does that. Your brain will just do that to you, whether you like it or not, Karen. Once you had too much alcohol, I'm sure you're well aware of that fact. From there, the two decided to stop by a house party at 34 Fairview Road, the home of Brian Albert, a Boston police officer, another one. They were going for what was essentially an after party. But the prosecution claims there was tension between them, arguments, signs the relationship was starting to unravel. By the time they arrived, the relationship was not just rocky, it was combustive. And of course, we do hear about that in the voicemails from Karen. I effing hate you, John. You're probably effing somebody, some other girl, all that. Was not in a good place, but does not make Karen Reed a murderer. It doesn't make John O'Keefe someone that's sleeping with other people. It's a toxic relationship is what it makes that. Here's where technology enters the story. John's phone had a Waze app running, the kind that logs movement and routes with almost surgical precision. And the Lexus that Karen was driving, it had a black box. Well, it's like a black box. It's a device that records things like speed, braking, and acceleration. Between those two devices, the prosecution says they can piece together the entire timeline down to the second. According to the data, the Lexus initially pulled past the house, parked near a flagpole at the edge of the property, and after sitting there for several minutes, John allegedly got out of the car. The fight was over, at least temporarily, but instead of driving off, the prosecution says Karen put the car in reverse, not idling or creeping, accelerating. They claim the data shows her car reversed 70 feet back with acceleration reaching up to 75%. That's how much the data can show from the vehicle, can show the percentage you are pushing down on a pedal. The data has no motive. It's just telling you what was done. The tires spun, snow kicked out, and at the end of that reverse, John O'Keefe was on the ground, skull fractured, phone beneath him, not moving. The Commonwealth says this wasn't a tragic accident. This was an intentional act fueled by intoxication and anger. They point to the lack of skid marks or brake engagement as further evidence that Reed wasn't trying to avoid anything. She was allegedly aiming. And then there's the aftermath. The prosecution paints a picture of a woman who drove away and then left him there, exposed to the cold. According to the data pulled from O'Keefe's phone, the temperature of the battery, yes, the battery temperature in his phone dropped from 77 degrees to freezing in under an hour. His health data, which logs movement, shows nothing after that critical moment, according to the prosecution, just silence. And right next to his body, broken red plastic, taillight fragments. Forensic experts say those fragments matched the right rear tail light of Karen Reed's Lexus. What's more, they claim to have found John's DNA on the taillight, on the casing, not on the inside where someone might have accidentally touched, but in areas that the prosecution says indicate contact during impact. Then there's the statement Reed allegedly made the next morning, not to police, but to a friend. and the statement that was in the Dateline episode. He didn't look mortally wounded. The prosecution zeroes in on that phrasing, not just the words themselves, but what they say about Reed's state of mind. If she really didn't know what happened, why that specific word, mortally? It suggests awareness that she saw him injured and left anyway. Her behavior after the fact didn't go unnoticed either. According to testimony previewed in opening statements, Reed called John's niece around 5 a.m. in a panic and then made a flurry of calls to friends, Jennifer McCabe, who eventually accompanied her back to Fairview Road. And they got close. Karen allegedly started screaming, "There he is!" Kicked the door until they let her out. She ran into the darkness and made a beeline for something, a mound in the snow. Nobody else saw it. Karen somehow knew to run directly towards this place in the yard that was covered in snow. And if you've ever seen snow in a blizzard and there's maybe a little mound, we're talking a body here. So you're talking, you know, about yay high, snow covering all of the ground. I don't know how you see there's a mound over there in blizzard-like conditions, but she did, and she ran towards it. She ran into the darkness and found his body exactly where the prosecution says she had left him hours earlier. Let's talk about the charges. This isn't first-degree murder. The state isn't trying to prove that Karen Reed set out that night with a plan to kill John O'Keefe. What they're saying is that her actions were intentional enough and dangerous enough to meet the legal threshold for second-degree murder. That means the prosecution believes she knew the risk. She acted with what the law calls a plain and strong likelihood that death would result. She's also charged with vehicular manslaughter while intoxicated and with leaving the scene of personal injury resulting in death. The prosecution's case hinges on the idea that the story is in the data, the phone logs, the black box, the taillight fragments, the temperature drops. They argue that while people can lie or forget, your phone doesn't get confused. Your car doesn't have a motive, and your digital footprint doesn't change its story. And Karen Reed, they say, left a long trail of data behind her, a trail that leads not to a mystery, but to a moment of impact. But of course, that's just one side of the courtroom. And as we're about to see, the defense has a very different story to tell, one that doesn't just deny those allegations. It accuses the prosecution of building their entire case on a lie. Not just a mistaken conclusion, but a full-blown cover-up. And it all starts with a single text message from the lead investigator, one that just might change how you see everything. The defense didn't walk into the courtroom just to poke holes in the prosecution's case. They came in swinging with a wrecking ball. And that wrecking ball had a name: Michael Proctor. According to the defense, Proctor wasn't just a sloppy cop. He was an architect of a cover-up, a fixer for the well-connected, a man whose first loyalty wasn't to the truth, but to the police inside the house where John O'Keefe allegedly died. And that house? It belonged to Brian Albert, a Boston police officer, a name that, according to the defense, carries a lot of weight in the town of Canton. His family, deep roots, powerful ties. Brian's brother, Chris Albert, sat on the Canton Select Board, which directly oversees the local police department. His wife, his sister-in-law, his daughter, all present the night of the party, all saying it wasn't just a gathering of friends. It was, in the defense's words, a who's who of Canton's most connected. And that, they argue, is exactly why this case spiraled into what it is now. The defense position is this, and it's fairly straightforward. Karen Reed didn't hit John O'Keefe with her car. In fact, they say there was no collision at all. No impact, no vehicular manslaughter, no reverse gear revenge. Instead, they allege John went into the house on Fairview Road and never came back. That something happened inside And what Karen found the next morning, his body in the snow, wasn't the result of a late-night accident. It was the aftermath of a crime scene that had already been cleaned up. They start with the body, John O'Keefe, 6 foot two, 216 pounds, found in the snow near a flagpole. The prosecution says he was hit by a 6,000-pound SUV, but the defense brought in Dr. Elizabeth LaPosta, a forensic pathologist and medical examiner, to look at his injuries. Her conclusion, not one injury on his body matched the profile of a car strike. This, of course, happened back in trial number one. No broken bones in his legs or arms, no hip fractures, no rib breaks, no contusions where you'd expect them. Not even bruising on his lower body, just a fatal injury to the back of the skull. A basal skull fracture that, according to the doctor, was consistent with an impact from a raised object, not a flat lawn. Keep in mind, there's a curb. There's a road. There's plenty of places where that could have happened other than a flat lawn. But according to them, in other words, not the kind of injury you'd get from falling backwards after being clipped by a car. Again, I don't know how accurate that would be, considering if you're there and you get clipped by a car, you may hit your head on the pavement for a moment. You may get up, you may move around, you may collapse again in a yard. Then there's the arm, the photos that are tough to look at, deep abrasions on O'Keefe's right forearm. The prosecution says they came from shattered taillight pieces, but the defense says, hold up. La-da-da-da-da, look at the pattern. Like that. Look at the spacing. The doctor says is expected to testify that these injuries look more like animal bites than anything else. Specifically from a large dog. And guess what the Elbert family had? A large dog. A dog that, by Brian Elbert's own admission, wasn't great with strangers. And guess who'd never been to that house before? John O'Keefe. The dog was rehomed not all that long after the incident. Maybe coincidence, maybe not. But the defense argues that timing matters and that detail matters because every unexpected variable, every missing piece, every conveniently overlooked clue starts to add up when you take a step back and look at the bigger picture. And that's when the defense zooms in on the investigation itself, or what they say was passed off as an investigation. Lead Detective Michael Proctor had known ties to the Elbert family. He'd attended weddings with them. His sister was reportedly close friends with Julie Elbert. The same people who were hosting the party where John O'Keefe was last seen alive. And yet Proctor was put in charge of the case. No recusal, no backup, no problem, at least according to the state. But according to the defense, Proctor's work was riddled with red flags. The house where the party took place, never searched. Witnesses, never separated. The scene, never secured. Blood on the front steps, overlooked. Potential signs of struggle inside the house, never investigated. The defense says it gets worse. They claim evidence was not just ignored, but manipulated. Let's talk about the taillight. The prosecution says fragments of the red plastic was found near John's body and that they match Karen Reed's Lexus. The defense doesn't dispute that the Lexus had tail light damage. What they do dispute is how and when those fragments got there. According to them, the area around John's body was searched multiple times in the hours after he was found. Nothing, no shreds, no plastic, no broken glass. Then after Reed's car was in Proctor's custody, after he had access to that taillight, suddenly fragments started showing up in the snow. Dozens of them. Like magic. The defense alleges this wasn't forensic discovery. This was a setup. And then there's the DNA. The state points to traces of John's DNA found on the taillight casing, but the defense fires back with their own lab results. Multiple unidentified male DNA profiles found on that same area. And even more troubling, John's own shoe recovered from the scene, reportedly had five separate unidentified male DNA contributors. If this was a solo accident, they ask, who else was touching that shoe? I don't know how strong that is. It may be stronger than I'm mentally giving it credit for right now, but it's a shoe. If you walk around anywhere, probably going to get some DNA on that shoe. So I'm questioning where the DNA was on that shoe, where they found it. Was it on the sole? Was it on the top? Where was this? Who else had access to the shoe? Did anyone else wear the shoe? Did somebody pick up the shoe before it was put into evidence? A lot of questions on that piece. They also point to a critical timeline gap between when Karen Reed says she dropped John off and when she found his body between midnight and 6 a.m. She believed he'd gone into the house to join the party. At least that's her story. Way after the fact. She fell asleep. When she woke up and realized he never came home, she started calling around. Not frantically at first, just confused. But as the morning went on and no one responded, that confusion turned into full-blown panic. And it's during that window, the defense says, that something happened inside that house, something that none of the people who were there have ever explained. They cite multiple odd behaviors, phone calls made in the middle of the night that partygoers later denied. For example, a 2:22 a.m. call between Brian Albert and Brian Higgins, both law enforcement, both at the party. Both denied the call happened until phone records proved otherwise. And then they offered up the same excuses, word for word, butt dial. Then there's the car. A Canton snowplow driver testified that he passed the house at 2:30 a.m. and didn't see a body in the snow. But an hour later at 3:30 a.m., he saw a Ford Edge parked in that exact spot, a model of car owned by members of the Albert family, according to the defense. If John's body wasn't there at 2:30, but was found in that same location at 6, someone had put him there. And the Ford Edge, they suggest, might have been the delivery vehicle. And then there's the Google search, a timestamp query from Jennifer McCabe's phone at 2:27 a.m., how's long to die in the cold? The defense says this is the smoking gun because John's body wasn't discovered until hours later. And McCabe told police she didn't know anything until that morning. So why was she Googling something like that at 2:27 in the morning? The prosecution? Well, they've explained it somewhat. They've had an expert come in the previous trial that actually is from Cellbrite. Said, hey, you're reading this wrong. That's actually the time the browser was opened when McCabe was looking up the basketball information for her daughter and got back up later, went back to the same browser in the heat of panic with Karen Reed, searched how long to die in cold then in those moments. That's how it was explained by experts. People actually make the code that was being deciphered. So take that for what you will. There's a lot of mixed pieces in here all over the place. What's cover up? What's not? Is there a cover up? What's just a lie? What's people that just don't know what they're talking about? You don't know what you're going to get behind any of those doors. That's what makes this whole thing so damn confusing. The prosecution, well, they'll probably explain what I just said again in this next trial. But the defense says all of this very much matters because it goes to knowledge. It goes to intent. It goes to whether the people in that house knew something had gone terribly wrong and were figuring out how long it would take for nature to cover their tracks. Karen, keep in mind, they're doing all of this in the heat of the moment, in the middle of the night, drunk, all conspiring, and then all sticking to their story, every one of them, including kids, for years. No one cracking. That'd be quite a conspiracy. Karen Reed's behavior that morning doesn't fit the mold of a killer, they argue. It fits the mold of someone spiraling into panic. She didn't call a lawyer. She didn't hide her car. She got in and started retracing her steps, calling friends, asking for help. And when she found John's body, she collapsed on him in the snow, screaming, crying, not running. Which, again, I think that points to this was not second-degree murder. Could she have hit him, though? I think that's a lot more likely than the other story. The defense doesn't just want the jury to question what happened. They want them to question who was never questioned, why the house was never searched, why Proctor never turned over key data, why phone calls were denied, evidence appeared late, and a dog was quietly removed from the picture. All legitimate questions, because none of it looks very good. And as their opening ends, they pose the biggest question of all. If the truth really is in the data, why does so much of it point somewhere else? Or how can there be such conflicting sets of data from both parties? Because now both sides have laid their cards on the table, two entirely different realities, one rooted in reverse acceleration and black box readings, the other in alleged corruption, manipulation, and institutional loyalty. Which now brings us to the most important part of the story, where the prosecution and the defense collide, where facts clash head on, where the jury will have to decide what's real, what's not, and whether reasonable doubt lives somewhere in the space between. Two versions of the same night, same street, same people, same time window, and yet the stories told in that courtroom might as well have taken place on different planets. Seriously. One version says Karen Reed, drunk and furious, reversed her Lexus into her boyfriend after an argument. The other says she dropped him off at the house full of cops and never saw him alive again. That whatever happened next was covered up to protect the powerful. And in the middle of it all, a jury being asked to sort out what's real, what's reasonable, and what's just noise. So let's walk through where these two stories clash into each other. The places where facts are agreed upon. But the meaning behind them couldn't be more different. And as we do that, please, in the comment section, let me know what you think. This is where the legal system lives, not in the facts themselves, but in how they're interpreted, challenged, and understood. Let's start with the cause of death. Everyone agrees John O'Keefe died from blunt force trauma to the head. The question is how. The prosecution says Karen hit him with her car while reversing. He fell, hit the back of his skull on the frozen ground, and never got back up. They bring in the neurosurgeon, who says the fracture is consistent with a backwards fall caused by impact from a vehicle. They call it a counter-coup injury, the kind where the brain slams against the inside of the skull after a sudden stop. But the defense fires back with their own experts, at least they did in the last trial, Dr. Elizabeth, who says that's not what this injury looks like at all. Good luck, jury. You got the two experts telling you two totally different things. According to her, the skull fracture is more consistent with a blow from a ledge or a step, not something you get falling on flat grass. Well, again, there is a curb there, so I don't know why that little idea is suddenly omitted. She also says there were no other injuries you'd expect from a car strike, no broken bones, no bruising in the lower extremities. I agree there. That's weird. Nothing to show John was hit by a 60,000 or a 6,000-pound SUV, just the head injury. And if the head injury didn't come from the ground, well, that changes everything. Next is the issue of timing. The prosecution says John was hit around 12:30 a.m., left in the snow for hours, and eventually found by Karen and two others just after 6 a.m. They point to digital evidence to back it up. His phone stopped showing movement around 12:31. They say an and its battery temperature drops rapidly. Proof he was already out in the cold. But the defense says, hold on. There's a snowplow driver who says he passed the house at 2:30 in the morning and didn't see a body. And an hour later at 3:30, he saw a Ford Edge parked in the exact spot. As I said earlier, if you're a snowplow driver, you're looking at the street. You're not looking into people's yards at that moment in time. So of course you'd see a car parked there. Why was there a car parked there is a bigger question. But I don't think it's a huge question as to why he says he didn't see the body in the yard. I don't know that he'd be focusing over there. Again, that's just my conjecture. I pick and choose from both sides because I think there are elements to both sides that create reality. There's a vehicle owned by members of the Elbert family, and that happens to be a Ford Edge. They argue this is proof John's body wasn't there earlier in the night, that it was placed there hours later, likely after something happened inside the house. Okay, that's the argument. That brings us to one of the most contested pieces of physical evidence, the taillight fragments. The prosecution says red plastic shards found near John's body match the broken light of Karen's Lexus. That alone might sound convincing, but the defense challenges everything about it. The timing, the collection, the chain of custody. They claim the area where the fragments were found was searched thoroughly in the early hours of the morning twice, and nothing was found. But after Karen's vehicle was seized and placed in the hands of Trooper Michael Proctor, those taillight shards suddenly appeared in the snow at the scene. Not a few pieces, 46, the defense says. It's not a coincidence, that's contamination, or worse. And then there's the DNA. The prosecution says traces of John's DNA were found on the taillight. The defense says the sample included not just John's, but also DNA from at least two unidentified males. And crucially, that none of the shards claimed to have caused injuries to John, that they had any DNA left on them at all. Just what's left on the car. And let's not forget Karen's own statements, because both sides are laser focused on what she said and when. The prosecution highlights what was admissible and what were the admissions made to the first responders. I hit him, allegedly said more than once. They argue this was a spontaneous emotional confession, not something you'd say unless it's true. But the defense argues she never actually said it. They point out that no dash cam, no body cam, no 911 call records her saying it. That none of the first responder reports from that day, not one, documented her saying it. The only person who later confirmed to have heard it was an EMT with ties to the Elbert family. And even then, even that came up 24 hours later during an interview coordinated by an officer who also happens to be Brian Elbert's brother. The defense says if this were a real confession, someone would have written it down immediately. And again, could she have said it? Yeah, very likely. Because she even herself has said, did I hit him? Could I have hit him? I hit him? Tone matters. I wouldn't be surprised if she said it. It does not mean it's a confession. It means someone is trying to put the pieces together while they're still kind of drunk. It doesn't have a memory of the night before. That's what it says to me. And then there's the infamous Google search. The prosecution didn't mention it in their opening statements. The defense made it a centerpiece. At 2:27 a.m., a Google search was made on Jennifer McCabe's phone. How's long to die in cold? This is hours before John's body was discovered. McCabe told police she didn't know John was dead until after 6 a.m. So why that search? Why then? Well, the state has offered their explanation. They've had the expert, like I said, come in and take a look at this. The browser was opened. That search was done later. That's according to the expert who makes the program, what they're using to interpret the data. Seems kind of believable that, okay, now that we know how the program works, Let's mosey on. It's not what you want it to be. Doesn't look crazy, but I think it almost looks crazier if Jen McCabe's looking up how long to die in cold to a friend of hers that's dying in the yard and then decides to look up basketball scores. That seems even more implausible, honestly. The defense says it's incriminating that it shows someone at the house knew John was out in the cold long before 911 was even called. Now back to the digital data. What's known as the black box in Karen's Lexus. The prosecution leans heavily on this. It showed acceleration in reverse, a rapid move backward around the time the phone stops recording movement. They say that the moment of impact and paired with John's Waze and health data, which showed no motion after 12:31, it all lines up. But the defense says the black box doesn't prove intent or even contact. It proves the car reversed. It doesn't prove it hit anyone. And as for the health data, they argue the phone may have been moved after the fact, that the readings don't track a body. They track a device. If John's phone was placed under his body after the fact, that would also explain the temperature drop and inactivity. All of this leaves the jury with an impossible task. Do they believe the data says what the state claims, or do they believe the defense's version that the data is either being misrepresented or was manipulated altogether? Then there's the question of Karen's behavior, her voicemails, her panic, her statement about him not looking mortally wounded. The prosecution says this is evidence of guilt. The defense says it's grief, confusion from someone who had just found their partner's body in the snow. And finally, there's the credibility of the investigation itself. And Michael Proctor sums that up. Just his name. Fired by the Massachusetts State Police for conduct related to this case, according to the defense, his fingerprints are on everything. The evidence collection, the timelines, the interviews. They ask, can a case be built on a compromised foundation? Ever be solid? Which is where this all lands. The jury isn't just deciding whether Karen Reed is guilty of hitting John O'Keefe with her car. They're deciding whether the system that accused her of all of this can even be trusted. Whether the digital evidence is truth or theater. Whether what we think we know, the phone data, the car data, the timeline, actually tells the whole story. Or whether something more complex, more uncomfortable, might be hiding underneath. Because in a courtroom like this, the burden isn't to prove what might have happened, it's to prove what did beyond a reasonable doubt. And whether or not that bar has been met in the eyes of 12 jurors will decide the fate of Karen Reed. It's a momentous task that this jury is going to be thrown into. Just hearing all of that, if you knew nothing about this case, I don't know where the hell your mind would go. Now, of course, this is all based strictly on opening arguments. We're going to break this case down every day. We're going to break down what was argued in court right here, where you're watching this or where you're listening to this. We're going to bring you the courtroom audio as well every day so you can listen with your own ears to what transpires in that Massachusetts courtroom. And we have experts who are going to discuss it as well. Names you probably know. Names you may like. Names you may hate. Bob Mata, defense attorney. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent. The two have very different views on this case. But I welcome that. Because like I say, I think the reality is in the middle somewhere. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. He's also joining us every day with conjecture and thoughts on this case. Eric Faddis, defense attorney and psychotherapist, and author Siobhan Scott to help us all make sense of this case. We have it all for you right here on the Hidden Killers podcast from True Crime Today. So do me a favor. If you haven't put some input in the comment section yet, please do. Press subscribe if you're listening to us wherever you're on the podcasts. And if you're on YouTube, press subscribe there so you don't miss any of our coverage on all this. And share this. Share it with others. Share our videos. Share our audio so others can join in. Because, again, I think the truth is in the middle here. I'm not free Karen Reed. I'm not on the other side completely either. I don't know if she did it. And like I've said before, what does that even mean? Did she do it? Did she physically maneuver a vehicle that hit John O'Keefe? I don't know that we're ever going to know the answer to that question. It's more so, did she do it with intent? Or was this a drunken night where a couple's having an argument? He gets out. She throws it in reverse to say, "One more thing, asshole," or whatever. Shouts out the window, drives away in a rage. Clearly, she was in a rage by the voicemails. We know that that is a true thing. It seems fairly plausible that she could have hit him and had no idea. I do not think she tried. I do not think she even knows. Her story has changed countless times. So what is it? That's for a jury to decide and for us to speculate on and talk about. So give me your thoughts. We have a lot to talk about in the coming weeks on this case. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us. We're going to talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.